I sat perched on a charpoy in the only bedroom in the flat, the long gungat of my sari draped over my face like a veil. It was difficult to maintain the pose Dave's mother had taught me. The sagging of the charpoy ropes kept threatening to topple me. By concentrating on keeping steady on the bed, I was able to take my mind off the despair closing in on me.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. Author Manil Suri is called an NRI back in the country of his birth. That stands for Non-Resident Indian. His first novel, The Death of Vishnu, thrust readers into the complex social microcosm of a Bombay apartment building. Vishnu was based on a real man who lived on a landing between the first and ground floors. Suri never got to know him and always wondered who he was and how he died. When Manil Suri began to write the novel, which won a Pen Faulkner Award, the author, of course, drew upon another Vishnu, the Hindu god who preserves the universe. Suri turned again to the rich symbolic possibilities of Hindu cosmology in his new novel, The Age of Shiva. Set in an India newly independent and bitterly divided, Shiva is a symbol of religious upheaval in the story of a woman's journey in love, motherhood, and family. Manil Suri is also a professor of applied mathematics at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. He says he seeks to inspire young writers to explore the intrigue of numbers. This reading of The Age of Shiva took place in February 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
So it has been a while, 7 years actually, and it's been that long, yes, people gasping in horror. But it got to a point where, you know, I would come for readings here for other authors, and I would try to hide my face because Carla would ask me, well, how's the book going? Or some readers would ask me, well, you know, we really enjoyed it. Did I miss the second book? Has it out yet? So I had to keep telling them for many years, no, just another few years, and it just continued. So anyway, it's been 7 years, and it's been very interesting, and I'll tell you more about it later. I thought I'd start just by reading out a few sections, and I'll start with the very beginning. Every time I touch you, every time I kiss you, every time I offer you my body, Ashwin, do you know how tightly you shut your eyes as with your lips you search my skin? Do you know how you thrust your feet towards me, how you reach out your arms, how the sides of your chest strain against my palms? Are you aware of your fingers brushing against my breast, their tips trying to curl around something to hold on to, but slipping instead against my smooth flesh? Ashwin, do you notice the wetness emerge from my nipples and spill down the slopes of my chest? Is that your tongue that I feel? Are you able to steal a taste or two? Ashwin, your eyes still closed, drops of moisture dappling your nose. Do you know how innocent you look, how helpless, as I guide the nipple towards your mouth? For an instant I feel like teasing you, drawing my nipple across your lips but only for a touch, and swinging it away, watching your tongue dart out in confusion, the fingers still opening and closing and curling, worry beginning to crinkle your face. And that helplessness, that exquisite helplessness in your expression, that need for my body, for the nipple that is yours, for the breast I have so cruelly taken away. Yes, love can be capricious, can it not, my sweet? But of course, I relent before I even begin. Your look suffuses me with guilt. I let your mouth close around me. I feel the pressure of your gums, your lips. The power in your jaws surprises me. A little more strength and I can see there will be pain. Your tongue pulls against my nipple. So practiced, so persuasive, so determined, how does it know what to do? I feel myself responding. Each tug brings liquid flooding up, engorging my breast, pushing out into your insistent mouth. Your feet twist and turn against my belly as you feed. Your hands finally find purchase on my breast. Fingers splaying out around tiny palms, your orb, your world held in your hands. I lose myself in the rhythm of your intake. Am I imagining it? Or is there a parallel rhythm that echoes inside me, a longing that rises through my body and trembles under my skin? I feel myself flush. I feel the color spread through my chest. Then I see your face, your forehead losing its worry, your eyelids no longer wrinkled tight. I watch the smile trying to train the corners of your mouth, and the heat inside me turns into warmth. There is nothing, I think to myself, as you let go of my nipple and turn to me filled. Nothing that can be as satisfying as this. Afterwards, I lie next to you. You fit so well into my body. Before closing my eyes, I take one last look. Your eyes, your ears, your hands, your feet, all these I check to make sure they're still there, still intact. Even the tiny curl of your manhood, nestling so innocently between the fleshy fold of your thighs. All this I have created. All this has come from me. As I drift off to sleep, I wonder if you will ever know these thoughts that flow through my mind. These soliloquies I address to you, this conversation I keep up in my brain. Perhaps one day I will tell you about the yearning from which you were born, the lives with which you can play, the planets over which you hold sway. Ashwin, the sign in the sky. Ashwin, the constellation of twins. Ashwin, the one who went before you, the one with whom you share your name. You are the hope and the fire, the absolution, the purifier. You will deliver me, will you not, from this life I find myself in? So that's Mira, who's the protagonist of the story. And the whole novel is told through her voice. And as you see, she's talking to her son, Ashwin. So this first section actually occurs in 1965, when Ashwin has just been born. And after that, there's a flashback to see where Mira came from, how she got married, and so on. And that takes us back to 1955. And that was a very interesting period in Indian history, because that's about seven, eight years after India got independence. It was a very male-dominated society. The first seeds of modern thought and, you know, moving away from orthodoxy were just being planted. So let me read you a little section of the first night that after Mira has gotten married. She finds herself through a bunch of circumstances married to someone named Dave, and it's a marriage that she's not sure she wants to be in. But she's just come to Nizamuddin, where her husband stays. Hema is Dave's sister, so it's her sister-in-law. And the other two characters mentioned are Arya, who's Dave's brother, and Sandhya, who's Arya's wife. So let me read a section of that. The electricity was out on Dave Street. "It's gone for the night," Hema announced cheerfully. "We're one of the first ones they cut when the city runs out of power." She held a lit match under a candle to soften its base, then stuck it upright on the arm of a chair. "We are just a government colony, after all. Not like the wealthy area where your father has his house." I sat perched on a charpoy in the only bedroom in the flat, the long ghungat of my sari draped over my face like a veil. It was difficult to maintain the pose Dave's mother had taught me. The sagging of the charpoy ropes kept threatening to topple me. But the position felt as centering as a yoga asana. By concentrating on keeping steady on the bed, I was able to take my mind off the despair closing in on me. "You can speak now, you know. Even take your ghungat off. All the guests have gone. Though you'll have to show your face sooner or later. All those people who've been saying it's your sister who's the prettier one." Hema held up a candle near my head, filling the inside of my ghungat with light and trying to peer through. "Besides, you must be dying under there, not being used to having all the fans all off. Tell me, is it true? Dev Bhaiya said you had an air conditioner at your house?" "We had two, one in the drawing room and one in Paji's library, but I remained silent." Well, you at least had lots of servants, didn't you? Dev Bhaiya said your father made a lot of money as a publisher. Not that we don't have servants, mind you. Well, maybe not a servant exactly, but we do have a Ganga. She comes in to clean the pots. No cook, though. Don't worry, we won't make you work. Not while you're a new Bahu anyway. When Sandhya Didi was a new Bahu, just married to Arya Bhaiya, she didn't have to step into her kitchen even once for the first month. Now Mataji makes her do all the cooking, of course. Though between you and me, her rice clumps so much the Ganga could do it better. I suppose we shouldn't expect you to be good either, being a rich man's girl and everything. I've already told my parents. When I get married, it's going to be to the wealthiest man they can find. Marry for comfort, that's what I want, not for love like you. Hema, my mother-in-law called. Stop that Dehradun Express tongue of yours and come right out. Coming, Mataji. Anyway, we'll talk more tomorrow. Tonight this room is yours. Arya Bhaiya and Sandhya Didi are sleeping with us in the other room, even though he's the elder brother. It's going to be tight. Plus all that rich wedding food must have given Didi gas again. And on top of that, she snores. Hema fluffed up a pillow and laid it at my feet. You have such pretty toes. But I guess that's what new brides are supposed to have, at least in the beginning. I'm sure my Bhaiya will be very impressed. She skipped to the door. Enjoy this special night of yours. So it takes a while for Meera to actually get into the rhythm of the household, and she gradually wins people over. She wins over the father and Dave's mother as well. The one person that's much more resistant is Sandhya, who's Arya's wife, so that's her sister-in-law. And I'm going to read you a section which sort of explains one of the big rites in India where people keep touching everyone's feet to show respect. And I see some South Asian people here, and I'm sure at least some of you have been through this experience. So let me just read this out. And of course, this was said in the 50s where things were even more fraught in a way. So let me just read it out, and then can talk about it a little later. And this sort of sets other things in motion. And I'll read another section which connects with this. Each morning after her bath, I would see Sandhya in the courtyard performing her puja of Arya. She would swirl an earthenware lamp resting on a round metal thali in a circle before Arya's face, as one might in front of a picture at a shrine. She would mark his forehead with ash from the platter, and sometimes dab on some vermilion and a moistened grain of rice. She would bend her head and wait for him to color the parting in her hair with a line of the vermilion. Then she would bend even lower to touch his feet, first the right, then the left. She would run the same hand over her head to bless herself as she began to rise. The first time I saw this puja, I stood in the kitchen transfixed. The touching of feet was a ritual strictly forbidden by our father in our house. All this scraping, all this servility, hasn't anyone in this country heard of human dignity? Aren't there enough gods in the temples already to satisfy this national hunger for groveling? We spent 2 centuries licking the boots of the British. Did you ever see them go around prostrating themselves at anyone's feet? Our cousins, of course, had all been taught to perform the ritual at the beginning and end of every visit to show respect to their elders. Paji would yank their heads back up the instant they started to bend. "Did you drop something?" he would demand. "Are you preparing to do push-ups? You can look around on the floor all you want, but I'll slap you if you touch my feet." For a while, when we were young, Biji tried to force us to go through the ritual when Paji was not around. "You insolent daughter of an owl, I don't care what your father says. I'll break every bone in your body if you don't touch your grandmother's feet." At other times, she would try to cajole us. "It's a mark of respect, nothing else. What's the harm in bowing before wisdom, before age?" She would tell us stories from the Mahabharata and the Ramayana to further her argument, such as the one where Bharat kept his brother's sandals on the throne when Ram was exiled into the forest. It's part of our culture, something that's come down to us from the ages, she would say. It's a dignified custom. You should perform it proudly, not be ashamed. Once Paji found out, he quickly put an end to Biji's efforts. What can one expect? The children in our village had to wash their parents' feet and drink the water afterwards in respect. Is that what she's going to teach you to do next? During the first years, Paji told us, there was a time when Biji wouldn't eat anything in the morning until she had touched his feet. She would tell me I was her lord, her protector, her provider, and she couldn't start the day without my blessing. When I stopped her, she would pull my shoes out from under the bed and perform her ceremony over them. When I hid those, she started waiting until I was in the bath to touch my house slippers instead. It was years before I could break her of the habit, before I could keep any footwear lying around unlocked again. So let me read you one last part. And this is related to a custom in India called Karwa Chauth. And literally that translates, Karwa is a kind of pot, and Chauth is the fourth day of the waning moon. And this is one of the fasts that wives traditionally keep for their husbands in Hinduism. They aren't supposed to eat from the time that the last star is visible in the sky to the time that the moon comes up. And so in the story, Paji, of course, being very liberal, has forbidden, you know, his wife to keep this fast. And Meera doesn't know about this fast. But when she comes to her husband's house, everyone, she's expected to keep it because they're much more conservative and orthodox and religious. Meanwhile, what's been happening is that Dev, her husband, wants to go to Bombay to become a singer. And he needs money to do this. Paji, who's Meera's father, has promised to give him this money. He's come for this fast, this Karwa Chauth, and he's there in the audience, and he's promised to give it to him, provided Meera does not touch his feet during the fast. So he's made this one condition. And so everything has been set up, and I'm just going to read you a part of this. I should just point out, Paji wants to get Meera out of this household because they're also religious, and he wants to send her to college. By 8, the guests were all gathered in the courtyard. Mataji had invited her friends to share in the auspicious occasion of my first Karwa Chauth. "There's Mrs. Sampat," Hema said, pointing at a woman sitting on the charpoy and kneading her chest. "She says she's going to get a heart attack, since she can't take her blood pressure pills during the fast. Last year she fainted, and the ambulance came and took her away. But people later said it was just to show off. And that's Mrs. Gangwal. She still keeps the fast, even though her husband ran off with her niece 4 years ago. And next to her, Mrs. Pota, whose husband no one's ever seen, the rumor is he's dead." I was having difficulty breathing. My jewelry felt heavy and constraining, the wedding outfit from 2 months ago tight and suffocating around my chest. My scalp was on fire, as if I'd used chili powder, not vermilion, to decorate the parting in my hair. Even the bindi on my forehead itched so fiercely, I felt like scratching it off. So I'm not going to go through some of the rituals. I'll just jump a little. "It's risen," Hema shouted, interrupting the ceremonies. "I can see it over there, next to the house." It was indeed the moon, its rounded edge already beginning to clear the treetops. We had been too absorbed in the rituals to notice a stealthy ascent. A hush fell over the congregation. Since I was the newest bride, it was my honor to be the first to break my fast. Sandhya helped me get up and bent down to arrange my foot on the center of the pestle. It felt cold and smooth against my arch, its convexity reassuring as I curled my toes around. Mataji handed me the sifter, and I held it up against the night. My vision swam as I did so. The moon looked a dirty white. I took the glass of milk from Sandhya and prepared to pour my offering to the moon. but I couldn't summon up the silent words that were to accompany this action. The women watched me and waited for their turns as I stood poised with the glass. Should I turn around to ask them what I should be praying for? Sandhya touched me at the shoulder and gently tilted my glass. I watched the thread of milk spill out and connect me to the earth. Dave loomed up in the sifter, his features curiously warped by the weave of the mesh. His nose seemed longer, his forehead too wide, the hollows under his eyes more pronounced. I looked at the blurred outline of his mouth and heard again the directions he had whispered. "Don't worry about Paji. I'll catch you in my arms before you can bend too much. It'll look quite natural. Instead of touching my feet, we'll end it in a hug." Sandhya exchanged the sifter and glass of milk in my hands for the fruit-laden thali I was to offer my mother-in-law. All that was required of me now was to follow Dave's instructions. He would catch me before I could complete my bow and feed me the first morsel to break my fast. Paji would nod approvingly from the charpoy upon seeing that Dave's feet remained untouched. Down at the station, the frontier mail would pull into the platform, ready to bear us away. Steam issuing out of its rearing engine, like from the nostrils of an impatient mare. I looked into Dave's eyes and saw he could picture the frontier mail as well. Was Bombay within reach now? Were his calculations proceeding as planned? Paji must surely have the same expression of self-satisfaction on his face. A daughter on her way to college, her life finally lived the way he wanted. Beside me stood Sandhya, her face shining with a serene beauty like a moon bride descended to earth. I'm not sure what exactly triggered my divergence from the script. A clarity, calm, incisive, emerged from my hunger to reveal the action I had to take. I stared into Dave's eyes, and this time his sureness faltered. His satisfaction dimmed. Realization flooded in and then alarm as he followed the direction of my gaze. I bent down before I could be swayed by the pleading beginning to distort his face. Too late he tried to grab me, but I dodged my shoulder out of the way. I descended so fast that an orange fell out of my thali and rolled into the crowd. Dave couldn't pull back his feet even if he wanted to. There were too many eyes focused on them. He stood rooted where he was, his face ashen, his toes as vulnerable and exposed as a statue's. I touched his right foot first, then his left, as Sandhya had instructed. The skin on his knuckles felt dry and surprisingly smooth. There was a quiver with each contact I made, as if my fingertips were delivering tiny electric shocks to him. I went through the motion of blessing myself by running my fingers through my hair. Then I rose, my head still bowed, ready to accept my father's rage, ready to accept the morsel that would release me from my fast for Dave. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Well, there was one other section.
Well, I've never tried this section, so
I didn't know you'd make me read. Boy, you really get your money's worth. Let's see where it is. So this is later on in the book, and Meera has actually gone to college, and she's kind of been a mediocre student. That morning, she's actually met Freddie, who was another girl in college, and Freddie was kind of cruel in many ways, but they've just met for lunch, and Freddie has told her all that she's been doing. She started this club, and she's a dramatist, and this and that. So anyway, that evening, this is what happens. And one other thing I should say, people are probably confused by the name of Meera's husband. It's D-E-V, not D-A-V-E. And, you know, in India, Dev is, it means God, actually. But it's pronounced Dave, which is different from Dave. So it's a subtle difference. And if you don't hear it, I'm sorry. We have 52 consonants or 48 consonants, and they're very subtle. That evening, Dave dragged me to the Soviet Expo for one last visit before it closed. Clumps of people stood enthralled around the tractors and mechanical hose, as if waiting for the machines to spring to life and start plowing the exhibition ground itself. There were gleaming models of MIG fighter jets, suspended in a glass case with a giant cloth backdrop showing Nehru and Khrushchev in a celebratory embrace. A woman sat at a desk in a stall, vending subscriptions to Soviet Life and Soviet Woman, 12 issues for a rupee, 24 for 150. Dave hurried me past everything. As always, it was the Ferris wheel that interested him. The sign claimed it was Russian-made, though it looked like the usual giant wheel with yellow canopies attached to spruce up the cars a bit. Dave helped me into the seat and secured the safety bar over our laps. We rose into the air in spurts, stopping each time for the loading of the next chair. "Look, you can see Marine Drive from here, and the Gateway and the Taj Hotel." Dave swiveled around to point, and our seat tilted back dizzyingly in the air. I followed the line of his arm, but the sights barely registered. What had I been doing with my life? I had mumbled something to put Freddie off, but her question still roiled in my mind. Why had I cut myself off from my job, from getting a taste of what independence meant? Why hadn't I taken college more seriously, established my own circle of friends? Why, for that matter, didn't I have my own newspaper column or theater company like Freddie had? I watched a trio of seagulls fly towards the sea, their white bodies receding into the dark. All my energy for the past few years had gone into resenting Paji or pleasing Dave. In the face of Dave's misbehavior, of his bullying, why had I let him get away with it? Suddenly, I no longer wanted to ride the Ferris wheel. I wanted to follow the seagulls and glide into the life I had not chosen. But the bar across my waist was locked in place, and the wheel had begun to descend, picking up speed. Dave squeezed my forearm and said something, but his words were lost before they reached me. The flags adorning the tractors came up to greet us, sickles and hammers waved in the breeze. I caught a flash of the attendant, his face a blur, his hand on the lever that controlled our speed. What if he forgot to ease off on the lever? Perhaps there was still a chance to be free. I imagined us spinning faster and faster, so fast that the wheel broke loose from its mooring. Bulbs exploding, canopies crumbling, riders trying to hang on as we began to roll across the grounds. The juggernaut flattening tents and tractors and cars alike as it barreled down the road to Flora Fountain. Its swath extending all the way to the dockyards where it splashed with a final bounce into the sea. But I remained where I was, unharmed and safe, but also undelivered to the liberating waters of the sea. The lights of Bombay kept swinging in their arc, approaching and receding under me. I lost track of the cycles, 5, 10, 15. They seemed to stretch on to eternity. And through it all, as we whirled together through the air, Dave's fingers retained their claim on me. "Wasn't that wonderful?" Dave said as we began to slow down. "Let's ride it again, shall we?" Okay, so that was the only other piece I had prepared. And I have something extra for the question and answer. Being a professor, I know how people do not like to ask questions, especially the first one. So I have a giveaway today. This will be given to the person who asks the right question. There is a question that I have.
Question?
No, there is a question in my mind, and when someone asks it, this CD is yours. And you might not want it, actually. But.
Thanks very much for the reading.
Thank you.
So the question, as I understand, this whole triptych project began sort of with a short story.
Right.
So I was really interested, just because I'm sure it's sort of grown so large, what the process has been like taking something from what was once a short story and something very finite and conscribed to something that's sort of spread out into what you're describing as this three-book project as a triptych, and sort of how you maintain the relationships between the book, at least in your mind when you're planning them out.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm glad you're using the word triptych, so thank you for saying that. And the reason for that is that these three books do not have the same characters. They do not have a continuing story. And so when I was planning the release with my UK publisher, they told me, don't, at any cost, we beg of you, don't call it a trilogy anymore. Because people are going to see the second book and say, well, we didn't read the first, so we can't read the second. And so this is a purely marketing reason that we are calling it a triptych now. But what happened was it started with a short story. Well, it actually started with a man that I knew. If you read the first book, The Death of Vishnu, there was a man named Vishnu who died in the building that I grew up. And I started writing a story about this. And I knew what the ending was going to be. And I started writing this, and I wrote about 20 pages, and I was nowhere near the end. So I wrote another 10, 15 pages, and I was still not near the end. And that's when I took a writing course, and the instructor said, you know, you might be writing something longer than just a story. Moreover, she said that this man's name was Vishnu, and she said that if you're going to write a story called The Death of Vishnu, you really have to connect it with the god Vishnu. And that's when I first started thinking about this connection and connected it with mythology, because before that, there was nothing to do with mythology. Finished that, finally, after 5 years, and it seemed to take long in these things. Finished that after 5 years, found an agent, gave it to my agent. She asked me, just before submitting it to publishers, she said, you know, publishers like to know what else you're going to be working on. So I said, you know, there are actually two other gods in this trinity. I could write a book on each one of them. Why not? You know, there's Shiva and there's Brahma too. And she said, okay, great. And then, you know, when I thought about it, I said, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Maybe I should call her up and, you know, tell her not to say that. She had already sent it out, and everyone by now said, oh, trilogy. You know, it was too, tried denying it, it didn't work. I tried retracting it, too late. So I was writing a trilogy, which was many years later going to become a triptych. But anyway, so now this trilogy, after I finished the first book, I just had one word to go by, and that was Shiva. It's like an exercise. You know, if you want to give anyone who teaches writing, you know, give the class a word and say, okay, write a book on this. That's what I felt like. And there was actually a pattern in my mind. Vishnu is the caretaker of the universe, much like Vishnu was the caretaker of this building. So I thought, okay, the death of Vishnu, then Shiva comes, you know, Vishnu is the caretaker. If Vishnu is no more, then Shiva will come and destroy the world, because Shiva is supposed to be the destroyer. I'll explain a little bit more about that later. And then once the world is no more, then Brahma, who's the creator, the third part of the Trinity, comes and recreates the world. And so I thought it would show this arc of destruction and regeneration, and somehow this would be transferred through my three books. Well, as it turned out, I had this elaborate setup for this book, The Age of Shiva, which was actually the life of Shiva before. And you know, it was supposed to be more about, I talked about Mira and her son. It was really supposed to be more about her son. But then I started writing, I said, let me write a couple of chapters about Mira, about where she came from, what her backstory was. Well, 200 pages later, the son still wasn't born. So I said, okay, this is her story, and I should follow her. And so that kind of threw my triptych or trilogy idea, the big elaborate thing that I constructed, a little out of gear. And so now I think of this book, of this triptych, more as something about India, where the first book really gave you a snapshot of the country in contemporary times, the 80s or 90s. This book actually shows how India evolved to that position, how we got there. It starts at basically at independence and goes up to about 81. And the next book, I'm going to try and talk a little bit about the near future. When I told this to Carla, she was not too happy. She says, I do not read books on the future. She announced that. And so I just want to reassure her, it's not the future, it's like tomorrow. What could happen tomorrow? So you'll have to read it, Carla. But that's a few years from now, so.
I wonder if you could describe the relationship between, your fiction and your mathematics.
There it is. That's the word. You win. So what you just won is a DVD called Taming Infinity, and it's a talk on mathematics. It's meant for lay audiences, that people who are not mathematicians. I've actually given that talk at the Berlin International Literature Festival to four captive classes of German school kids. And I've given it in other places like art colonies, and that's, you know, this is all math outreach. I feel that I should use this pulpit to really push mathematics, since it's never in the cultural realm. So what was your question again? Okay. So actually that's a question that, you know, obviously I've heard before, because I knew someone would ask me. And I try to come up with a new answer each time. So the answer this week is, you know, I've got several different answers. I mean, there's parallels and so on. And then the other answer is that, okay, one helps me relax from the other when I get rid of one. But the answer this week is kind of, you know, it's a non-answer. Sorry, but that's just this week. Next week, you'll get a different answer. And the answer this week is that, you know, I people ask me these kinds of questions, like, just to rephrase your question, if I wasn't a mathematician, could I write this book? You know, I've been asked that same question in this other way. It's impossible for me to answer that question. And you know, I propose that if it's too late now, but, you know, if there could have been two of me, you know, twins separated at birth or something, one grew up to be a mathematician, one didn't, then you could really test this theory. Did the mathematics really play a role in the writing of this fiction? But unfortunately, that can't happen. So I'm still working on a good theory.
I saw in the story very much the traditional story of a girl's rebellion against her father, sort of turned on its head. Mira is rebelling against a very progressive liberal father, yes, and goes in a very conservative orthodox direction. I was just wondering why you decided to do it that way and what inspired you.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I've turned many things on their head. I mean, that's what a writer is supposed to do, I think. At least this one. Maybe it's something to do with mathematics, you know, just always twisting things around. But if you think about it, what were the choices available? You could have Mira's father to be a very, you know, because the whole idea is, okay, this is a story about a woman making her way through this post-independent landscape that's quite male-dominated. So you could have a traditional father who's a real tyrant and pushing his daughter in certain ways, and then Mira rebels. And, you know, the audience would be rooting for her, and she would be a noble heroine. And that's what I didn't want. I didn't want her to be ever a noble person. She wasn't. And the reason for that is there are so many books with, and there's a whole sort of subgenre where women are thrown into this situation, which is completely out of their control, and then they somehow go through various steps, and they rise, they're steadfast, and they rise above their circumstances, and they finally triumph at the end. And that's not the book I wanted to write, because I've read it so many times, and I'm sure you have also. So here is a very flesh and blood character who makes lots of mistakes. The only way that she can assert her identity is to rebel, is to react. And so, you know, this is a time where there are very few real choices for women, where there are roles thrust upon women, and she is going to really react against her father, because that's the only way she can assert herself. Now, what kind of person should her father be? Well, my grandfather, you know, to pluck a leaf from my own life, he was a doctor, and my mother wanted to be a doctor. And my grandfather said, no, you cannot be a doctor. He forbade his daughter from going into medicine, because he said, it's too difficult for you. It's too difficult for a woman. That's what he said. This was in the 40s. And that led to a lot of frustration in my mother's life. That's always stuck with me. And what I thought I'd do here is just twist that around, so that the father actually wants to have his daughter educated, and she's the one who, in order to rebel, says that I'm not going to go ahead with this. I'm not going to follow what you do. And so it's this constant twisting around that I find interesting, and I hope readers do too.
I was wondering if you always write in English, or if sometimes you write in another... What's your first language?
It's English.
It is English. I see. Okay.
But I guess the thing is, when I speak with my parents, I speak in both Hindi and English. But all my education was really done in English, and I guess that is something we owe to the British, because in India the educational system is very interesting. And this is touched upon a little bit in the book as well, in one little scene. But there are schools that are vernacular medium schools, and then there are schools that are English medium schools. And there is a strong push amongst all sections of society to try and put children into English-speaking schools. Because that's the ticket to everything. If you know English, there's a whole bunch of jobs that open up for you. There's a whole bunch of educational possibilities that open up. And so really, that's the ticket to a better life. So anyone in the middle class and above would just find that English is their first language. And, you know, I can write in Hindi, but, you know, it took me 7 years to write this. It would probably take me 700 years to write a book in Hindi.
What kind of preparation, if any, did you have to do to take the voice of a woman versus a man, since obviously it's not your own personal experience?
One thing I didn't do is, you know, wear a sari and sit around the house. But initially what I did was I thought, okay, the way to do this is to read up everything that I can get my hands on. So, you saw the first scene that was breastfeeding. So I typed in breastfeeding on the web, and, you know, all these pages came up. About newly borns and their mothers and the experiences that they describe, and that was very helpful. I also read up all sorts of things, you know, everything from Of Woman Born, classic feminist text by Adrienne Rich, to, I don't know, as I said, on the web and other texts. At some point I found that, okay, you can only read so much, and it's not going to get you beyond a certain point. And that's when I sort of stood back and said, okay, I hadn't yet written anything. I sort of paused and then waited a little while and then actually started writing it. The first thing that came out was that scene that I read out in the beginning. Meera's voice just came from somewhere, and I was delighted to have these words come out and be on the page. After that, after the first few scenes, though, I really had to get into her character completely and, you know, say, well, how does she think? How does she view her son? The son that she develops this intense relationship with. And it was very small steps that I took in her mind, you know, really feeling things around inside her almost, looking at the world through her eyes, looking at her son through her eyes. It was a long, I mean, that's one of the reasons it took so long, but it was also very fascinating, just being so intimate with the thought process of a woman. And it was also a sort of high wire act because I wasn't showing it to anyone. And I don't know that many women. Certainly, you know, couldn't ask, well, can you tell me something about breastfeeding? That kind of question, I didn't have anyone to ask. And so I only showed this to people after I'd finished it. So I wasn't sure if I'd gotten it right or not. So that was interesting. But I had to really follow my intuition. That's what really, you know, kept things going most of all. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.